Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Birds Hunting and Landscape in Malta. This talk is delivered by Professor Mark Anthony Falzon.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome back to the radio audience of Campus FM to the 2014 series of the seminar series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. It's been going now for 17 years, and we're very happy tonight to welcome Professor Mark Anthony Falzon, the head of the Department of Sociology, but also, it has to be said, an anthropologist as well, to give his talk on birds, hunting, and landscape in Malta. Mark has been doing, as many people here know, has been doing a great deal of field work on the subject of birds, hunting, and landscape, and he has published on the subject in various journals, including the well-known journal Anthropology Today, in which he had a wonderful article. Professor Mark Anthony Falzon holds a doctorate in social anthropology from the University of Cambridge and is the head of the Department of Sociology. His books include Cosmopolitan Connections, published by Oxford University Press in 2005, and Multi-Sited Ethnography, published by Ashgate in 2009. So, Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Paul. Actually, it's just two books, so it include, that's what they include, basically. So it's a somewhat pretentious title, I suppose, Sher Wazo, Birds, Hunting and Landscape in Malta. There are in this country 13,000 or so licensed shooters and or trappers. That means a staggering 75-plus hunters per square kilometer of huntable land. Like many other small islands, Malta is poor in resident breeding birds. Apart from a handful of hardy species, none of which are considered to be particularly interesting to Maltese hunters, the countryside in summer, and to a lesser extent in winter, holds little by way of game. The taking of resident game birds is therefore an ocean unknown in Malta, and hunters must rely on the spring and autumn migrations. This, and the high density of hunters, which means that they often have to hunt close to roads, villages, and tourist haunts, are the two key characteristics of hunting in Malta. It is not always the case that arguments for or against hunting refer to the landscape. In England, for example, the reams of reports written in the run-up to the hunting ban of the early noughties all but overlooked that aspect. A glaring omission since, certainly in the case of fox hunting, the encounters between the hunter and the hunted are given meaning through references to the places and spaces within which they are enacted or performed. These encounters create a social geography of the countryside that, quote, overlies, transgresses, and textures other more familiar spatial geographies such as farms, parishes, and counties. As Marvin puts it, the landscapes of the countryside are not merely a stage or a setting for the event, but rather they are essentially constitutive of fox hunting. Thus the importance of studying the relations between the hunter, the hunted, and the landscape. In what follows, I shall take up this point to explore some of the many and complex relations between Maltese hunters and their environment, focusing in particular on hunting as a spatial experience, access to land, and its transformations and contestations. The main idea is to present a work-in-progress report from the field, but I shall also draw on a number of scholarly sources in order to make some sense of it. A small qualifier. Although there are a number of differences between hunting and trapping, I shall be using the word hunter generically. Hunting is very much about a hyphenated being there. That is to say, hunters experience and talk about their passion primarily as a set of spatially located practices. By way of a parallel, one might refer to the paintings of Gustave Courbet, for example, which bring together valuations of hunting and the landscape into coherent and unitary images. Responding to a survey questionnaire in 2006-2007, Danish hunters mentioned, quote, experiencing nature, followed by good fellowship, the social dimension, that is, as their prime motive for hunting. Our case is no different, in that one of the main attractions of hunting is that it brings practitioners in contact with the countryside. Contact here is a deceptively simple word for what is in effect a complex, elemental and multisensory experience. Take spring hunting, which Maltese hunters are so loath to give up. The opposition, and it is both numerous and vociferous, tells of the short-sightedness of killing birds on their return passage, a few weeks before they breed, and the relatively short distance from their breeding grounds. Be that as it may, the myopia is evenly spread on both sides. That's because the main point of spring hunting is that it takes place in spring. Hunting is, for hunters, the best, possibly the only way, of experiencing spring. They will talk of diffa, a kind of early morning stillness and mist which envelops the countryside and which tends to produce turtle doves, as do overcast weather and drizzle. The days start to get longer and brighter, the Maltese countryside is at its verdant best from mid-March to late April, and that is also the time to nibble on a few broad beans picked from some field. Birds, too, behave differently. Unlike in autumn, turtle doves in full breeding plumage wing their way across the fields at speed, egged on by their breeding instinct, their namra, actually, just like that of their catchers. Nesting sparrows produce a particular alarm call, izzerzer in Maltese, every time they see a large bird, a sound that tautens every hunter's nerves, which raises questions that are often asked by non-hunters. If it's all about the countryside, why do hunters have to hunt? Why can't they just sit there and enjoy the countryside, like the rest of us? The reason why a hunter will never ask such questions is that being there is never a neutral state. It is always embedded in ways of inhabiting, rather than just being physically in a space. One might cite Heidegger's distinction between space and place, where spaces gain authority not from space appreciated mathematically, but place appreciated through human experience. The multisensory complex referred to earlier is indeed human experience, but there is one crucial missing ingredient. The link between hunters and that complex is the gun. Being there is not enough. It is being there with a gun that matters. The gun effectively serves as a key device which connects a hunter to his landscape, broadly defined. It represents the possibility of appropriating that landscape by doing something in it, and possibly converting it into something meaningful, namely a bagged bird. The hunter relates to his environment not as an abstract being, but rather as a technologized self. By analogy, birdwatching is also very much about experiencing the countryside, and it is quite possible to see and identify many birds without the help of binoculars. But put a birdwatcher in the field without binoculars and you have a lost soul. Less poetically, one who is largely unable to convert a sighting into a record. If you look closely, you might recognize some people. This was taken many years ago, so we've changed a bit. Even if binoculars have their limitations, they combine with the bird watcher's skills to produce a complete and technologized self. It is ultimately this complete self that makes experience and meaningful inhabiting at all possible. In the case of hunters, there are two facets to this inhabiting. The first is the experience itself. Hunters often talk about being fu'il jebla, sitting on a cold stone, as the ultimate sublimation of their passion. Once on site, The Maltese hunter inhabits a complex three-dimensional world, co-produced by the landscape and its natural and naturalized contents, the presence of other hunters, and of course, birds. Let me look at each of these in turn. The landscape itself is made up of two components, land and sky. The first affords, as Tim Ingold would put it, a typology of features and what ecologists call microhabitats. A hunter will know which features and areas in his patch are most likely to serve up a particular species of bird. For hunters, the countryside is schematized as a complex architecture of hunting possibilities. It brings to mind Maurice Bloch's description of Malagasy shifting cultivators surveying the forest for promising patches of swidden. Bloch argues that when a Malagasy farmer tells his friend, "Look over there at that bit of forest, that would make a good swidden," he draws on a cognitive schema that is partly visual, partly analytical, though not necessarily in a sequential, logical way, partly welded to a series of procedures about what one should do to make and maintain a swidden. In the case of Maltese hunters, the possibility of birds, albeit crucial, is just part of a composite schema. That also includes, for example, the attraction of what we might call sites of male domesticity. Most hunters who hunt on their own land manage, in some way or other, to work their way round a rigid planning regime and cobble together a small room or two. Typically, these contain a few pieces of recycled furniture and are used for storing hunting paraphernalia, cooking, and sleeping. A few hunters actually live in these rooms for the duration of the season. More commonly, they spend their days there cooking, having siestas, cleaning, and so on. It is also very common for hunting and agriculture to coexist in a kind of bricolage, but a discussion of that aspect is beyond the scope of today's piece. Being there also has an elegiac quality to it. In contemporary Malta, a deep-felt anxiety runs through understandings of and relations with the countryside. This is the result partly of a building spree that took off in the 60s and to date shows little sign of wearing thin, partly of reactions to it in the form of vigorous environmentalist movements as well as popular perceptions of loss. Hunters regularly talk of the landscapes they roamed as children, when good hunting grounds were often within walking distance from village centers. Perhaps more importantly, they cultivate mental images of the even more rural world their forefathers hunted in. These images often take the form of nostalgia for an idyllic time when land was plentiful and built-up areas few and far between, and when hunting was a treasured part of a rural moral order, and, more broadly, a general moral order steeped in tradition, timeless certainties, and solid families and local communities. My informants commonly reminisce about a time when Mass was said at 4 a.m. at country chapels, specifically for hunters, who would then spend a couple of hours among the clover and caribs and shoot as many birds as needed for the day's meal. Turtle doves would migrate in such huge numbers that they filled the sky bisaffi in Maltese, literally in layers. In contrast, hunting today is thought about in terms of a dwindling countryside, greatly reduced migration, fierce competition among hunters, and the perennial headache of surveillance by the police and anti-hunting activists. The irony is that environmentalist and anti-hunting movements are predicated on the same sense of loss and anxiety. Only for these movements, hunting is one of the threats to the countryside. For hunters, it is the exact opposite, a form of enduring relationship and stewardship. To move to the second component of the landscape, the sky is imagined as a stack of layers, saffi, through which birds fly. Hunters talk of birds flying fil kawkba, with the stars, or, more interestingly, through Is-seba saf, or is-seba sema, literally the seventh heaven of cosmological tradition. The link with the religious imaginary is also present in expressions like Ant Christu or Mola Alla, used for very, very high-flying birds that appear to fly through God's own layer of sky. There are some more colorful expressions, but I'm being recorded for Campus FM, so I think I'm not moralizing, by the way, I'm tempted. But the presence of other hunters in the field is described by the expressions tawaraya and taudimi, the ones behind and in front, or, in the common case of terraced slopes, tafui and tatahti, the ones above and below. These neighbors would be known to the hunter and may even be kin or friends. While in the field, the hunter is constantly in touch with them on a two-way radio and or voice contact. Thus, for example, if a bird happens to fly past a hunter, he will radio or turn around and shout, "Il afuek," birds flying in, to the one behind him. These networks tend to develop into rich and long-lasting relations of friendship and camaraderie, which often spill over into areas of life, family, work, and so on, other than hunting. The other side of the coin is competition, and sometimes bad blood, and a studied lack of cooperation between neighbors, often due to some breach of hunting etiquette, for example, shooting low or out of range, or poaching into a neighbor's airspace. The practice of hunting effectively transforms the Maltese countryside into one vast tissue of criss-crossing networks of kinship and friendship, and trust and its opposite. I might add that mobile phones have made it possible for hunters to greatly extend their real-time knowledge of exactly what happens to be migrating where. My time in the field is punctuated by frequent calls to and from family and friends, following which the hunter will turn to me and say things like, "Naha tisfel andhom il-gamim," there are doves in the south. We would be up in Melliha, for example, or something. Being there is an intense multisensory experience that is not limited to directions and visuals. Take sound, for example. The Maltese hunter inhabits a soundscape made up of the sounds and noises of human and other presences, the calls of birds, and the artificial calls produced by one's and other people's recorded decoy calls and whistles. Bracket, traditional calling devices have in most cases been replaced with pre-recorded calls on mobile phones and high-spec bird callers. These are technically illegal, but in widespread use nonetheless. This soundscape is not so much heard as experienced. It can be hard to figure out how hunters manage to distinguish the call of a migrating bird from all the cacophony. The word they use is tos, to feel, rather than tisma, to hear. It is as though they feel slight changes in the soundscape. This is one of many ways in which being there is also a synesthetic experience. With respect to birds, they are seen to inhabit the landscape, and therefore the hunter's space, in a variety of distinct ways. I have already referred to birds flying in the seventh heaven. The opposite of that is ones that fly za'ommalart, with their bellies touching the ground. Birds fly attul, away from the hunter, or adrit, towards the hunter. These are sometimes inverted. Birds that are present in an area for any length of time become talpost. In a fascinating mirror image, they wise up to the characteristics of a place, and especially to its dangers, including hunters. Such birds are known as hazin, cunning, or bid-diploma, graduates, and are normally very hard to attract using decoys or to outwit in any other way. The obvious is birds talpassa, migratory, which are seen as spatially unschooled and relatively easy to attract and shoot, unless weather and other conditions contrive to render them vlejech, arrows, mahrubin, in a hurry, or gasmal piancha, full speed ahead, and therefore unlikely to settle or otherwise to present a shot. These are all expressions I hear all the time in the field, as I'm making these up. Let me now take a theoretical detour. The biophilia hypothesis constitutes a useful point of departure. originally proposed by E.O. Wilson in 1984, it holds that humans have a tendency to pay attention to, affiliate with, or otherwise respond positively to nature, and that there is a partly genetic basis for this tendency. Applied to landscape, the idea is that we retain in our genes, as part of an evolutionary legacy, that is, a preference for types of natural settings that would have favored survival by virtue of their association with food, water, and shelter. Ulrich proposes that the classic type would be a savanna-like environment because of the advantages it presented to early humans. As he puts it, quote, "Certain broad classes of natural elements, especially water, green vegetation, and flowers, should be visually preferred over most modern synthetic elements, such as glass and concrete." Surprise, surprise. He goes on to cite a body of experimental data which ostensibly show that European, North American, and Asian adult groups consistently respond with high liking to unspectacular environments that are savanna-like in appearance. Ulrich does concede that there are problems with external validity and cultural variation, among other things. But his general conclusion is that the preliminary evidence is broadly compatible with the part of the biophilia hypothesis which posits a preference for a certain type of environment. As for a genetic basis for this preference, he is more cautious. Still, quote, "The overall record of findings on landscape preferences is more plausibly reconcilable with a conceptual perspective that encompasses both learned and genetic influences than with an exclusively learning-based explanation." Close quote. Further, these preferences can and often do have therapeutic implications. Research on recreation experiences in wilderness and urban parks has yielded evidence consistent with the biophilia hypothesis by suggesting that restoration benefits, stress recovery that is, stem at least partly from exposure to natural surroundings. Colin Jerolmack provides a recent antidote, and I think we need one, to Wilson's sociobiology and its spin-offs. Focusing primarily on New York, Berlin, and South Africa, Jerolmack's work is based on a fine-grained ethnography of pigeon fanciers and pigeon-human relations in urban contexts. The object, this is a very wonderful ethnography, by the way, recently published a couple of months ago. The object is telling, since pigeon flying seems, at first glance, to be a means by which urbanites transcend the city and urban society to reconnect and communicate with nature. In fact, it turns out that keeping pigeons is rather a way for the New York fanciers to embed themselves in a social world and compete for status. And even though Turkish fanciers in Berlin say that pigeons anchor them to nature, Jerolmack's data show that they also anchor them to their ethnicity and notions of homeland. Crucially, these encounters are neither antithetical to nor less authentic than those that foster a felt connection to nature. Jerolmack draws comparisons with Durkheim's and Levi-Strauss' thought on totemism to argue that social categories have always structured our relations with animals, and that, contrary to the biophilia thesis, the sanctity of such relations can sometimes result from their unique capacity to enrich social life. Obvious though this may sound, it flies in the face of everyday folk understandings of nature, some of the environmental scholarship, as well as the mystical prose of authors like Henry Thoreau and John Muir. Since I would like to understand the exact nature of my own data on hunters and the environment, I shall take up this theoretical strand later on in the paper. But meanwhile, back to the field. The inextricable nature of being and there also means that for hunters, land is the crucial resource. With respect to hunting rights, Primdahl et al. Draw a distinction between northern and southern European countries. In the former, the right to hunt tends to be linked to the ownership of land. In Denmark, for example, every rural landowner has the right to hunt on their own land, provided it is larger than 1 hectare. That right may be shared with, given to, or leased to other persons for a limited time if the property is larger than 5 hectares. With the exception of coastal waters and beaches, this is in Denmark, the right to hunt is linked to property and cannot be exercised separately. In southern European countries, on the other hand, the hunting right tends to be based on the res nullius principle, by which game belongs to no one, and the hunting right is not directly linked to private property. That said, access to land where to hunt is crucial. In Malta, there are 4 distinct and hierarchized types of access to land. First, through individual or joint ownership. Second, by short or long-term lease. Third, through some form of an informal but enduring relation with the owner, land leaseholder. And fourth, by means of an unregulated presence on site. Actual ownership of land is by far the most desirable type, in part because of the prestige of landowning in general. Landowners, usually from well-heeled and urbane families, classically hunted on their own land and had the privilege of deciding who to invite to join them, usually some combination of peers and local subordinates. This was the case until about the 1970s, when hunting in Malta experienced a degentrification and became increasingly associated with rural and working class circles. With some exceptions, hunters who own land today tend to be from rural backgrounds, with some history of local land purchase. Degentrification also meant that much land was parcelled up and sold to erstwhile tenants, or self-employed tradesmen whose income makes it possible for them to buy land they never had any historical connection to. The upshot is that a significant chunk of the countryside is today made up of small parcels of land owned separately or jointly, usually kin, by hunters and farmers who hunt. I need to explain this. The name is made up, by the way, okay? For obvious reasons. This is a site where I do field work sometimes. It doesn't look like much, but I realize I'm pointing at nothing here. Okay, so it's mainly made up of 2 bits. This grayish bit here is garig. It's rock. Bare rock. Well, it's not bare at all. It's rock. Rocky, with all the flowers and things that come with it. And then there are some trees that were planted by these people. This is a family hunting land bought by a family as a corporation, brothers really, for big sum of money. It's a very good hunting area. And then there are some fields and semi-cultivated fields. In all, it's about 12 tumuli of land. So the point here is that this is jointly owned, as I said, by brothers and their sons, not being sexist, by the way. This is the way they explain it to me. And of course, the right to hunt comes with the fact that one has dished out money to make the purchase in the first place. They also rotate within the patch. So, for example, this is probably the best. You can just about make out a hide here. This is the best hide for various reasons, which I'll explain later. It's the place to be most of the time. There is a lot of, this is in demand, and the brothers take it in turn. They rotate. So, for example, if you go there on Monday, you'll find Joe. You go there on Tuesday, you find John. Wednesday, you find Charles, and so on and so on. They actually rotate. So this is it's corporate ownership of land. This is a very, very common scenario, especially in places like Bahria and the south as well. In any case, this is a more kind of looks like something. It's the same place, of course. And these are the trees I told you about, eucalyptus, acacia, and now pines. I'll get to that eventually. And this is the garrigue area, which is maintained in a sense, that is left as garrigue because there are species that favor that kind of, it's a bit of a compromise between turtle doves and quail. The second type of access to land, that is, consists of lease, of which there are various arrangements. The surest involves land which is leased by landlords to tenants for a small annual rent over the very long term. This type of quasi-feudal lease is characterized by historically embedded rituals that bind generations of tenants and landlords, a seigneur, in an enduring and strongly hierarchized set of relations. The second type of lease is less long-term and usually involves small to medium-sized parcels of land that are formally leased out for periods of several years by landlords who share a social background with tenants but who have no interest in hunting and/or agriculture. The third consists of the informal seasonal lease or sublease of very small holdings, sometimes simply a spot where to sit and wait for migrating birds. This last is essentially the purchase of the right to hunt in a particular place for a few weeks during the spring or autumn migration period. It is a means by which landlords or tenants on a long lease earn some cash on the side by allowing hunters access to their patch. Although it is renewable, it doesn't normally imply long-term rights and obligations. The third way in which hunters access land is through informal relations with landowners and or leaseholders who in many cases would also be hunters themselves. Kinship, both consanguineal and affinal, is crucial in this respect, but friendships are also significant. This is another one. It's actually, this is really very interesting. Again, the name is made up, okay? It's somewhere in the south of Malta. The setup is something like this. This is kind of rectangular. Here is a stud farm, okay? Or racing horses. And it belongs to a particular family. My hunter, John, is married into the family. He has no land himself, but he's married into the family. And there's a kind of long-term concession based on kinship in this case. He has this really tiny corner here, which is actually a very sweet place, with a small hide, a tiny room where he stores his coffee, his olives, and things like that. But the point is that John's access to land is directly through family relations here. This, again, is a very, very common setup. And affinal kinship can be very crucial here. So marrying into a family who has some land or access to land. I have many, many cases of this. I wish I could go into more detail, but obviously I don't have time. But a very, very, very common setup. The fourth type of access is something of a... Sorry, I forgot to tell you that obviously there's quite a lot going on here. So, for example, John might take time off from hunting to feed his family. They also have a kind of like a menagerie, really, with all sorts of exotic animals and things like that. So he might take some time off to feed the animals. It's it's very much a conviviality, and on that depends his right to hunt in that place, which to him is absolutely important. And I'll say why in a second. Because the fourth type of access is something of a hit-and-miss affair. It involves hunters who have no fixed and or stable place where to hunt. Some of these are accommodated at a woodland estate, owned by government, Il-Mizib, and administered by the Hunting Federation. The rest have to make do with looking for unoccupied places, usually on government land, or to hunt on private land during those times when the owners aren't looking. The expressions, which is not often during the migration season, the expressions used are tilha il post, to get there first. For the former type, tkun ftannis, to be on other people's land, for the latter. So you can see what John has managed to avoid here. Tkun ftannis, because of course he's married into the family, so it's not exactly ftannis, because the nis are also his own family. Tkun ftannis is also to be at their mercy. It means a lack of attachment in terms of both knowledge and affect to a patch of land, itself such an important facet of hunting. It also means the inability to transform land by planting trees and so on. In this case, because he's married into the family, John has managed to get them to sort of agree for him to plant a few trees around his hide. So tkun ftannis means the inability to transform land by planting trees and so on. That is why all hunters wish to be ftiak or fihwejek, which means to be on one's own property, or one to which one has some kind of regular and regulated access, as I've described. There is a process by which all hunters try to get a foothold on this version of the property ladder. The simplest way is to buy land or lease outright, and indeed recent years have seen a rush to do so, and its corollaries, the parceling of land and spiraling prices. In places like in Tahleb, this is really very obvious. More complicated schemes include exploring and tapping into one's kinship networks and transforming local acquaintances into more durable friendships, usually through some kind of reciprocity. The last resort is to try to hunt in unoccupied patches, somewhat a rare species in Malta, which tends not to be prime hunting land anyway. Much of this land is located in coastal areas or inland, close to buildings and along roads. The scramble to get there first often means leaving the house in the middle of the night and sleeping in the car or sitting on a very cold stone until daybreak. I now wish to move on to a discussion of some of the ways in which hunters transform land. Before I do that, however, it is essential to build some understanding of the ways in which different landscapes attract migrating birds differently. It is well known in the ornithological literature that day-flying migrant birds are aware of the landscape beneath them. They are often and obviously seen to follow coastlines or ranges of hills and to fly along valleys or the edges of forests and deserts. The phenomenon is technically known as leading line, as opposed to broad front migration, and offers a number of advantages. The ability to scan the visual landscape allows birds to maintain their migration direction, possibly by point-to-point use of a succession of landmarks. It also enables them to monitor and perhaps correct and compensate for any tendency to be drifted off course by crosswinds. Such features also provide favorable air currents that reduce the energy cost of migration. The disadvantage is that if many birds follow a leading line, if too many birds follow a leading line, there will be greater competition for any staging areas, places where birds stop to rest and or feed along that route. Two main leading lines have been described for the Maltese Islands. The first concerns the autumn migration of raptors, birds of prey, things like eagles and falcons and so on, over the hill ranges in the western part of Malta. The second, the migration of ducks through the north and south Comino channels. That, however, is only a very small part of the story. There are, in fact, many hundreds of minor leading lines. Indeed, I would say that every place has its roots. Hunters pay zealous attention to these flight paths. That's because a sighting matters very little to a hunter unless a bird is or promises to be in the hand. The key dividend of leading lines is that they bring birds within shooting range. Hunters use the term yabduni, an intriguing inversion of roles, since yabduni literally means they catch me, for birds that make the grade. a few meters can make all the difference. As John told me, quote, I have access to a small patch at Talolia owned by a friend. In spring, it's not bad. In autumn, however, it's hopeless. Turtle doves hug the ridge and pass me by just out of range. I end up sitting there all day, watching them fly past without firing a single shot. So his friend isn't much of a friend. That's the easy part. The usefulness or otherwise of these leading lines, indeed often their very occurrence, has to do with a number of variables. The first is, of course, the lie of the land itself. Probably the most desirable formation is that of hill ridges and cliff faces, what are known as shfarijiet in Maltese. The sides of within valleys are equally good, especially if they happen to be tall and steep. Another thing that matters considerably on a small island is the ways in which migrating birds make landfall, in Maltese, jaqbdulart. Again, distinct features such as headlands tend to attract more than their fair share. The upshot is that hunters position their hides, this is a very good example, along these natural topographical formations and wait for leading line theory to do the rest. It doesn't always oblige, which brings me to the second variable, weather. I mentioned earlier that two reasons why birds follow topographical features are to compensate for crosswinds and to utilize favorable air currents. What that means is that leading lines are directly affected by weather conditions, and especially wind strength and direction, both of which are subject to tremendous and rapid variations. A hunter must somehow factor in all of these variables and learn the different configurations of his patch. So, back to the another site, close to the one I mentioned earlier. Again, a made-up name. Obviously, what I'm about to tell you won't make much sense, but in the field, these people will tell you, for example, there is a shifer here, an edge. Sometimes, especially in autumn, when turtle doves are migrating, not a very common sort of happening, but anyway, they will just sit and watch, because the turtle doves will more often than not fly along this ridge, so completely out of range. In the spring, for example, birds sometimes take a bit of a detour along this little valley here, and that brings them in range. They have visibility, there's almost 360 degree visibility here. So for example, if the wind is, if it's an easterly wind, that's good for turtle doves, especially in the spring, birds would tend to fly in this direction, follow this valley here, and if they survive, they get to within range of this family. So the point I'm making, the details are relevant. The point I'm making is that it's actually in the spring, it's sometimes sort of revealing to sit and listen to hunters as a bird flies just out of range, a bit too high, for example, but along a leading line. You hear these volleys of shots, sometimes 50 or 60 or 70 shots on a single bird, by different hunters as the bird follows the leading line. 60 is a bit maybe exaggerated, but dozens of shots as the bird flies along a leading line. Because, of course, hunters would be positioned along that leading. Incidentally, this argument is relevant because I have to put this in a nutshell. Hunters very often point out that the number of shots has nothing to do with the number of birds actually killed, bagged. I won't go into it for obvious reasons. It's not the right place. But there are these two arguments. So, for example, conservationists will very often correlate number of shots with the chances of birds. Hunters will tell you no, because the number of shots has nothing to do with number of birds killed, because you could get 50 shots on a single tet. So, you know, it's complicated and there's no easy way out of it, but anyway. This one is there goes my confidentiality. In any case, it was no big secret about it. This guy is really hemmed in by Halfar, which until the late 70s used to be fantastic, really, because it was an open area, really, which attracted lots of birds, but now is factories mostly, and so it's not terribly good for. There's also this little valley called with Znuber, and now there is the Freeport as well, and Ivan, when he told me what it's all about, he will point out, for example, that when a northwesterly wind will bring birds from this direction within range. So for people who hunt on this side of the island, northwesterlies can be very good, as opposed to the previous place where a northwesterly is pretty much useless. You can sit there for hours and not fire a single shot, really. But in the south, northwesterlies are, because of the configurations of the... this is really quite complicated. Is it a science? I'm sure it is, but it's not an exact one. And that's the attraction of it, really. To further complicate matters, these configurations are in most cases, you can't see the configurations here, but please take my word for it. These configurations are in most cases seasonal. For example, it is well known among hunters that both turtle doves and quail tend to stick to coastal areas on their autumn migration. In spring, they also occur inland, jolart, in a more dispersed fashion. This is by no means a trivial detail. In 2008, and following a host of pre-litigation infringement procedures, the European Commission, EC, instituted a case against the government of Malta for having allowed, by special derogation, the spring hunting of turtle doves and quail between 2004 and 2007. The case was heard by the Luxembourg-based Court of Justice of the European Communities, and the final judgment passed in 2009. In a nutshell, the Maltese government built its case on the lack of what it called a satisfactory alternative to the spring hunting season. The argument was based on two premises. First, that Malta lay at least 300 kilometers away from the main migratory routes, and that the numbers migrating were small in any case, but especially so in autumn. Second, that while spring migrants tended to fly over the islands in a dispersed way, the autumn migration was almost exclusively concentrated along the west coast. It followed that since, quote-unquote, 80%, I'm not sure where they got this from, of hunters hunted on their own land, and that only a small part of that land was the west coast, a ban on spring hunting would effectively make it impossible for most hunters to hunt at all. In the event, the court didn't entirely buy the argument, partly because it argued that the island was too small and easily accessible to draw such territorial distinctions. The point, however, is that popular wisdom of seasonal leading lines ended up formalized in hundreds of pages of scientific evidence and presented as such before the EU's highest legal body. Don't ask me about the outcome of this case, because there are two versions. Hunters say the case was lost by the EC, and the opposition say that the case was won. Malta lost it, that is. I have my opinion, but I'll keep it to myself. There is, however, a third set of variables, and it brings me to a crucial part of this paper. Hunters don't just accept the lie of the land and the whims of weather and season passively, as it were. Those who own land or have regular access to a particular area work hard to transform their patch into an attractive prospect for migrating birds. If it happens to coincide with a leading line, they pour love into the marriage. If it doesn't, the leading line must be invented. The ideal is for one patch to serve as both chosen route and preferred staging posts. Trees, so these are two examples of a, these are leading lines, essentially, shfariyet, all right? But, of course, they've been improved or sort of embellished by hunters who planted trees along the leading lines, thus increasing the chances of birds flying along their path. The ideal is for one patch to serve as both chosen route and preferred staging post. Trees are considered to be the best means of approaching this, especially since turtle doves and thrushes are woodland species. Clearly, one bird's loss is another's gain. Quail and plover, for example, are open country species. Still, one must keep in mind that turtle doves and thrushes are the favorite quarry of most Maltese hunters in spring and autumn, respectively, and in any case, open country doesn't normally require actively to be made, or requires less attention. Chercher Oiseau is the best advice that can be given to those who desire to understand the Maltese countryside. The landscape is systematically transformed into art jebbieda, literally pulling land, that has the potential to pull migrating birds. The ways in which Maltese hunters transform the landscape are distinctly different from the processes described by Richards for grouse moors in Britain, for example. In the latter context, gamekeepers transform the land to best keep the game, to propagate and contain the quarry, that is. By contrast, Maltese hunters, dependent as they are on migration, think exclusively in terms of attracting birds to their patch. This fundamental difference points towards a type of appropriation of nature that is not linked conceptually to wildlife populations and their conservation, so much so that the commonly observed decline in migrating birds is invariably put down by hunters to factors other than hunting in Malta, things like pollution, war in Libya, and so on. I'm tempted to extrapolate the argument to small Mediterranean islands in general. Certainly, Theodosopoulos reports a similar conceptual disjuncture on Zakynthos, and my own fieldwork on Lampedusa supports the idea. Some of my informants there even told me they believed that a radar installation on the island had seriously impacted leading lines. So this shows the kind of the separation, the conceptual separation between hunting and populations, essentially. It's a very profoundly consequential separation, by the way. Let me use trees as my case study of land transformation. Trees have not, in recent history, been a major player in the Maltese landscape. 19th and early 20th century photographs show a treeless countryside marked by intensive agriculture and grazing. The only exceptions were the maquis-type vegetation of valleys and the clumps of carob trees that interspersed agricultural areas and were used as a food source. The pods were used as animal fodder to make carob syrup or simply eaten. It was only in the 1960s that afforestation came on the state agenda as a means of greening the island. Thousands of, by the way, this is the same place. You can see the very big difference. It was only in the 1960s that afforestation came on the state agenda as a means of greening the island. Thousands of pines and other trees were planted on government land within the context of what one might call an Irish butter advert morality of colour that valued green as rich and desirable and brown as poor and undesirable. In part, this morality was peddled by the environmental NGOs that were born in that decade. There was also a parallel process by which large swathes of land came to be valued in aesthetic and leisure-related rather than agricultural terms. The story is long and complex, but suffice it to say that by the 80s, the latest, stands of trees had mushroomed all over the countryside, and especially in prime hunting spots. The most incredible examples, I know. There's even a kind of a raised walkway here between hides, because the trees are so dense. You can actually tell where the ownership of land begins and ends very clearly. Someone who owns the field. This is in Delimar, I think. Yeah, Delimar. A very, very common sight. I'm not surprising you that much with these pictures. Most of these consisted of eucalyptus and acacia, natives of Australia and Africa, respectively. There are two ways in which this is relevant within the context of this paper. First, the increasing presence of trees has served to change the geography of the leading lines I talked about earlier. Many hunters are of the opinion that illum il-gamim tferresh. Nowadays, the turtle doves have dispersed. What they mean is that the classic leading lines of ridges and valleys have somewhat lost their accent as migrating birds head for the trees instead. Whether or not that is indeed the case, the point is that the average hunter perceives the landscape and his presence in it as fluid and competitive. Newly planted trees are thought to siphon off at least their fair share of migrating birds. The leading lines change, and so do one's chances of taking a shot. It's a kind of competition, the rules of which keep changing. Partly, the result is a perennial urgency on the individual hunter constantly to improve his patch, provided it is, to some extent or other, indeed his, and to make it more attractive. Second, there is a strong association between the morality of trees and that of hunting. Greenery is one thing, greenery that comes from eucalyptus and acacia trees quite another. Environmentalists complain that these species are aliens that poison the soil, deplete water sources, and use up space that would otherwise be occupied by the native and beneficial types, pines, olives, caribs, and such. The language of trees thus serves to construct hunters, first as a threat to the Maltese countryside, and second as egoistic. The latter says the only reason why they might prefer eucalyptus is that it grows rapidly. The distinction was formalized in Legal Notice 200 of 2011, which outlawed the planting of aliens, and especially acacia and eucalyptus. The notice included three schedules. The first and second lists of protected and strictly protected natives, respectively, the third of invasive, alien, or environmentally incompatible species. These two photographs I find quite sweet. They're on Camino, both taken on Camino, a couple of minutes walk, actually, from one another. The first is a tree planting project run by BirdLife Malta. BirdLife Malta have an observatory and a bird ringing station there. And you can see the type of trees planted, mostly pines, and they're a bit young, they don't really show, but there are some oaks as well, holm oaks, and some other species, some other kind of native endemic species. This is essentially the same idea, tree planting. But it's run by a hunter this time, and it's a like I said, it's un camino on his land. And the trees in this case are eucalyptus. So we have the same idea, tree planting, really, but very, very different species and a very different morality linked to each of these. So tree planting is a generic term for a very, very different set of practices and a very dichotomized set of practices as well. It will not, I mean, this picture would give many environmentalists a heart attack. This one, many hunters would look at that and say, what's the deal? There's nothing there. I'm not saying one of the parties is right and the other wrong in this sense, because I'm not talking about ecology here. I'm not competent to do so anyway. I'm just talking about valuations of trees. It will not be easy entirely to wean hunters off eucalyptus especially. It grows fast and tall and is considered a magnet for migrating turtle doves. Given my earlier point about competition, it is easy to see how the species lends itself. That said, that is because it grows fast and tall, and therefore, you know, one is very well placed to compete in this battle for leading lines, for migrating doves. That said, hunters themselves are increasingly adopting the moralizing language of native versus alien, though not, of course, its associated morality of hunting. The reason for this shift is that it promises to bring hunting in line with environmentalist notions, themselves seemingly backed by science and its prestige language of invasion and incompatibility and endemisms and things like that. Hunters in Malta today know that those notions and the legal structures that come with them are there to stay. They realize that the best hope for the survival of their practice lies in their appropriation. The tree of choice for many hunters has become the olive, usually saplings imported from Italy, ironically enough, which, although relatively slow growing, is seen as equally attractive to birds and produces the side benefit of fruit. The local production of olive oil has shot up in the last 10 years or so. The fruit, that is, olives, lends it special moral value in light of fashionable assurances of the magical attributes of a Mediterranean diet based on olive oil, the economic possibilities of boutique production, and so on. So planting olives, as opposed to planting eucalyptus, really locates you within a very desirable moral framework. It is not just trees that make up this moralized landscape. One of the perennial arguments against hunting is that it restricts access to much of the countryside and in any case makes a birdless eyesore of what's left. Keen to shed the compliment, hunters emphasize that their activities actually embellish and protect the countryside. The word naddaf is significant in this respect. It generally means to clean, but in hunting circles it refers, this is a picture of a trapper cleaning the site. This, I owe this picture to Ray. There, yes, yeah. There's nothing illegal about this, by the way, so I'm not revealing anything. Unless there are protected species or whatever. So the word naddaf generally means to clean. But in hunting circles, it refers to two things. First, the transformative processes, weeding and so on, by which hunting land is cleared and tended to. Thus, one might say, naddaft el mansab, I prepared the trapping site. Second, the more staple sense. Hunters will point out that they spend much of their time cleaning up after Sunday afternoon trippers and the image, dirt, rubbish they leave behind, or that they rescue rubble walls from the destructive practices of people looking for snails. Significant, because rubble walls are considered a picturesque and desirable feature of the Maltese countryside. So you see how this whole discourse is appropriated. In a rare moment of truce, the Hunters Federation recently joined hands with Nature Trust in, and I hope I'm right on this, but in an initiative, I'll be told if I'm wrong, in an initiative to replace unsightly hides, those built of corrugated iron or metal drums, in other words, in a nature park, with corbelled ones made of rubble. Although both believe they do, neither side has a monopoly on the making of rural idylls. These are pictures taken in Mizip, the government hunting estate I mentioned earlier, and well, they're self-explanatory, really. The place is full of these signs, Tom Mitch, you know, Ibsasiger and all that. Grouse moors in Britain provide a useful parallel. The managed grouse moor is a manicured patchwork of short and old heather growth. The former provides food and the latter shelter, and gamekeepers see to it that the grouse get both. This set of management practices doesn't please everyone. Critics view such a landscape as an aberration and a departure from and a displacement of natural land. Further, these negative evaluations are sometimes linked to apparent evaluations of the people as elitist and so on, the opposite of what happens in Malta, involved. Those who find cause to object to the landscape of the Grafsmoor do so because its management practices, the identity of the people directing them and their purpose are all bound together in the evaluation of the landscape, just as they are in the minds of its apologists. The point of view of gamekeeping and hunting apologists is telling. If the hunt and the moor are inseparable, then rather than being forced to conjure up some utilitarian benefit in the activity of killing the quarry, arguments on vermin control and so on used in fox hunting, shooters can cite the characteristics of the grouse habitat itself in support of the shooting which creates and maintains it. Again, though, this is contested. For example, whereas Stott sees cessation of moor management as offering the prospect of the regeneration of native pine woods, Hudson announces the worrying advance of afforestation in different terms. Thus, forests here are portrayed as more than simply a landscape, with different purposes and extents of human involvement being cited to imply an evaluation, negative in one case and positive in the other, in relation to the Grafsmoor against which they appear as an alternative. In the case of Malta, the critics object, first, to lack of access, for example, one of the taglines used to collect signatures for the spring hunting referendum was precisely to reclaim the Maltese countryside. Second, the second thing the critics object to, that is, to modification and habitat destruction by hunters and trappers, though this is often seen as a scientific argument and used in technical circles. Third, to the spoiling of an aesthetics of the countryside by unsightly dury hides and such. This is, you find many of these online, this is very recent, posted by a local environmentalist, and the complaint is that a trapper has just sort of obliterated a patch of a rare flower, which is the wild iris, apparently missing a couple here. This was on Facebook. Anyway. So this is one of the arguments used. Third, to the spoilings of an aesthetics of the countryside by unsightly dury and such. Let me now commute back to my theoretical space. I'm almost finished. I have so far shown how hunting is about a being there, which serves to appropriate and transform nature into a cultural product. My earlier discussion of biophilia and Gerald Max pigeons, together with my data, seem to show as much. There is a risk that this might end up in a facile and predictable statement that the human environment is culturally constructed. One set of directions away from the constructivist cul-de-sac is provided by Tim Ingold. Ingold's starting point is Gibson's concept of affordances, defined as that which the environment offers the animal, including the human animal, what it provides or furnishes, either for good or ill, that is. In contrast with superficially similar formulations by von Exkull, for example, Gibsonian affordances are said to exist as inherent potentials of the objects themselves, quite independently of their being put to use or realized by a subject. But objects only become useful and meaningful in and of the interaction because between their inherent affordance and the practical action of subjects using them. I quote, affordances are properties of the real environment as directly perceived by an agent in a context of practical action. Thus, our perception of the environment operates in terms of what it affords for the pursuit of the action in which we are currently engaged. Such direct perception of the environment is a mode of engagement with the world, not of a mode of construction of it. The device of active engagement rescues ecological anthropology from a Cartesian dualism of cognition over action, and instead posits a model of synergy between person and environment. Further, the coupling between active engagement and affordances steers us clear of a constructivist model in which the environment is simply the result of a cognitive exercise of perception and classification. Surely a good thing, since such a model, a constructivist model that is, effectively dissolves the reality of the environment in which we live, reducing it to a mass of stimulus prods which give rise to a chaotic flux of ephemeral sensations. I'm quoting it from Ingold. Ingold's drift is summed up in the following sentence. The cultural construction of the environment is not so much a prelude to practical action as an optional epilogue. The coherence of Ingold's scheme rests not least on his belief that the environment is the embodiment of past activity. It is, as he puts it, an enduring record of and testimony to the lives and works of past generations who have dwelt within it, and in so doing have left there something of themselves. It is also in this sense that the environment is not, as a facile cultural constructionism would have it, a tabula rasa onto which meanings are inscribed by conceptually detached processes of human perception and thought. I quote, "To perceive the landscape is therefore to carry out an act of remembrance, and the remembering is not so much a matter of calling up an internal image stored in the mind, as of engaging perpetually with an environment that is itself pregnant with the past." With respect to hunters, Ingold holds that they learn through an education of attention. The making of a hunter involves mentoring by seniors who point out features of the country and their significance, as well as a multisensory process of self-discovery. The experienced hunter is the knowledgeable hunter, as Ingold puts it, and the one who can recognize and value subtle and nuanced cues that may be insignificant to the untrained eye. That knowledge is ever a work in progress and often expressed or explicated in the forms of myths or stories. By and large, I subscribe to Ingold's argument. Take three examples for which his model can be put to much productive use. First, the leading line cartography I described earlier might be seen as an instance of the hunter making sense in rather than of his environment. Rather than being cognitively used to construct an otherwise empty space, they are experienced in the course of practice. Of course, part of that knowledge is inscribed in the landscape itself, notably as mediated through mentoring routines by avuncular figures. But the individual hunter keeps on adding and subtracting instances and narratives throughout his life course. Leading line cartography is therefore a work in progress. Second, the second example. What I said about the tradition of spring hunting and the local narratives of the and the located narratives of the type inscribed in the landscape would dovetail with Ingold's notion of acts of remembrance. Third, Ingold's scheme also helps us understand why hunters who are blapost feel, without place of their own, that is, feel and are seen as second class. If it were simply a matter of a temporal construction of landscapes, any hunter could make sense of their environment as they wished. In fact, being blapost means that one is not able to engage with and make sense in an increasingly familiar and known context. Thus, because it lacks the human-environment interaction, the whole experience of hunting is devalued. It is also relevant in this vein that hunters who have on occasion hunted abroad will invariably say that aħjar taqbad gamima wahda Malta milli elf leġittu. One turtle dove bagged in Malta is worth 1,000 shot in Egypt. Hunting abroad, unless one hunts regularly in the same place, simply cannot offer the dwelling experience that hunting in one's familiar patch can, which doesn't stop hunters from paying several thousand euros to spend 2 weeks in Argentina, of course. But then there are other aspects to hunting than the relation between a hunter and his environment. Which brings me to my final point, that of contestations. The standoff between hunters and environmentalists has always involved an element of in-the-field surveillance by the latter. in my years as a bird watcher, for example, I regularly used to find myself at the police station, filing reports on some form of illegal hunting. Binoculars, and sometimes camera, were the tools of bird watching, but they doubled as surveillance devices. Eventually, mobile phones made the trip to the police quite unnecessary. Hunting and trapping also regularly caught the eye of another camera-toting group, probably simultaneously drawn and put off by notions of Mediterranean machismo and images of garden birds in small cages, tourists, finches that is, tourists have proved themselves a key player in the surveillance game. The point is that hunters have always had to deal with an unfriendly gaze, and sometimes, always, I'm wrong on this, in recent decades, had to deal with an unfriendly gaze and sometimes with its consequences. Police lethargy, however, meant that the consequences came only rarely and that the threat of the gaze was a minor one. Indeed, it was common for hunters to poke fun by drawing comparisons with voyeurs and such. Mooning, too, was not uncommonly part of the fun. A photo in Natalino Fenech's book, Fatal Flight, showed the hunter doing just that to the photographer, while perched on a rubber dinghy out at sea, no less. This refers to what I told you earlier about acts of remembrance. It's a very, very interesting place, actually. Until 10 years ago, or so, when environmentalists chanced across an idea. Rather than simply rely on bird-watching routines, they decided to hold camps. Foreign volunteers would be invited to Malta during the peak of the migration season, provided with basic accommodation and organized into field units that spread out across strategic spots in the countryside, armed with powerful telescopes, notebooks, and mobile phones. The model was an imported one. It had produced dividends in Sicily, where volunteer camps had, over the course of several years, managed largely to bring to heel the illegal shooting of birds of prey around the Straits of Messina. One of the key players was the Bonn-based Committee Against Bird Slaughter, CABS, a privately funded organization set up in Germany in 1975 to curb illegal hunting practices throughout Europe using direct field action. CABS is a sort of cross, I hope to do it justice, because it's between an anti-hunting lobby and the Hunt Saboteur Corps. By 2004 or so, Maltese hunters, although I should say they are careful not to sort of intervene directly these days, by 2004 or so, Maltese hunters had to contend with a new presence in the field, that of parallel surveillance groups run by BirdLife Malta and CABS, and of course, with a corresponding increase in the number of police roaming the countryside. It's hard to overemphasize the import. This is a very sweet one. It's hard to overemphasize the import of this innovation. A new word was added to the hunter's register, siccatura. Literally, this means tightness, and in this case, it refers to a tightening of enforcement. It's not just environmentalists who use Facebook, of course, hunters. There's sense of humor online, and this, the militarization almost of the landscape as hunters see it. Huh? Of course, bird life people will tell you it's not enough. Hunters complain about the siccatura. Literally, this means tightness, and in this case, it refers to a tightening of enforcement. In part, this was due to mounting pressure by the EU Commission on the Maltese government to clean up the act. Coupled with the presence of bird life camps and CABS, the Maltese countryside was turned into one vast panopticon. Although old habits die hard, it was now no longer sufficient to moon and give the finger. The transformation of land by hunters had always taken into account leading lines. Now, sight lines were added to the equation. Even as the watchers developed a set of what they called watch points, strategic points, from where large tracts of land can be monitored, the rubble walls got higher, and CCTV became a not uncommon fixture in country lanes. You see the sign very commonly in the countryside these days. CABS counter-transformation reached its peak in spring 2012, when a Swiss engineer was brought in to fly a sophisticated drone over the countryside. 2 days into the mission, this was a really sophisticated piece of kit, I mean, you could fly it to Sicily and back. 2 days into the mission, a hunter mistook the device for a bird and shot it down. The point is that for hunters, it didn't help that it had a huge Red Bull sign written on it. I think it lasted 2 days, at 1 or 2 days, I'm not exactly sure. I'm now told that this spring the police intend to bring over a drone of their own. I'm not sure about the Swiss engineering of the Malta police force, but you know, if it took 2 days to shoot down this masterpiece of Swiss engineering, I can't imagine how long it's going to take. The point is that for hunters today, being there is also something of a cat and mouse game of partial, this was the first and last picture, I think, taken by the drone, by the way. The point is that for hunters today, being there is also something of a cat and mouse game of partial visibility. In conclusion, what I've had to tell you is extracted from a largely finished chapter of a monograph that is currently trying hard to break the procrastination routines. I have had to skim over a number of issues that will be discussed in much more detail elsewhere. Still, I hope to have convinced you that the relation between hunting and the environment in Malta today is neither a matter of encroachment by cowboys, nor one of a straightforward stewardship by countryside saints in camouflage who like nothing better than to nibble on a handful of broad beans in the shade of an olive tree. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark, for a wonderfully clear and ethnographically extremely rich and wide-ranging survey and analysis of the whole hunting scene. You certainly convinced me, at any rate, that the environment is not something, the landscape or the nature, is not something pristine, but is rather something alive with movement and various creatures, including human creatures, transforming it all the time. It's certainly difficult for me, after listening to you today, to see the environment or nature as something which hunters are the enemy of. They seem to be as much involved in creating and generating nature as farmers are with their terracing and their crop planting of various kinds. So I certainly thank you for having taught me that. I would like to know what people in the audience think, because clearly his paper raises a number of issues, including, of course, deeply moral ones, because anybody familiar with the nature debates knows that part of the crisis is a crisis of perception, and as Mark has just pointed out in the last 10 minutes, 15 minutes of his presentation, you have very different approaches. So the ways in which the landscape is being moralized and remoralized differ greatly between groups, and particularly between those who are against hunting and those who are hunters. We're looking at two entirely different moral visions of nature and of the human interaction with nature.
Mark, what I'd like to ask you is, you mentioned the camera D, and you mentioned that sort of there can be people who are seen as friends and people who are seen as not friends. And I wonder, the young people who are socialized into becoming hunters, I don't know, the sons of hunters or maybe the nephews of hunters or maybe the friends, what happens in that socialization process? Can you tell me something about that? How does somebody from a boy become a hunter?
It's a very big question, but it's usually seen by hunters to be kind of a combination of two things. First of all, some innate essence that I'm reporting from the field here. Okay, and so hunters will point out that, for example, I have two sons. One is a hunter, one isn't. And that to them is proof that to be a hunter is much more than simply learning to be one. It is to be born a hunter. There are lots of expressions in Maltese, tkun namra, tkun jofi, fit dem, and all this. But that's the prerequisite, okay? Now hunters know that, or think that there are, that some of their peers do not actually have this innate essence, and they believe that eventually they will stop hunting. Okay, so to be a hunter in an enduring way, one needs this inner essence. But then, of course, one is also initiated into hunting. And this is where, for example, avuncular figures step in, not just fathers, but sort of uncle-like figures, who take these young men through the processes of, today I focused on learning about the environment, so learning about the leading lines. So, as Ingold said, to be a good hunter is to be a knowledgeable hunter. It's all about knowledge of, in today's paper, knowledge of the landscape and what it can produce. And there are, of course, other aspects to do with gun lore and sort of things like that. And attracting birds by making calls, things like that. So it's a bit of a mix between an innate, what is seen as an innate substance which needs to be encouraged, and something which comes through learning. There isn't really a point at which one becomes a hunter, I think. I've thought about this, and I don't think there isn't actually a definite threshold. For example, older hunters will refer to younger hunters who may be 50, and they say "fal," so children. You call them children, and they will also say, "Oh, these children, they know nothing about the landscape. They know nothing about birds. They have no understanding for." Of course, the 50-year-olds in turn will refer to 20-year-olds and say, "Tfal, these tfal are unlike us." So, that's why I said also it's an unfinished project. I don't think there is a moment at which one becomes a hunter. One has to be born a hunter. Of course, let's not go into the demographics of that. One has to be born a hunter, but, for example, not many hunters are born of bird watchers, it seems. A bit strange. But then that one, once one is born a hunter, and hunters will tell you stories of, for example, really young sons making a dash for the gun cabinet, for example. This innate sort of substance. In fact, at some point there was also a suggestion, which I kind of see the point making it legal for 14-year-olds to hunt supervised. I think the law is like that in the States, for example. But anyway, let's not go into this again. But there isn't one moment at which one becomes a hunter. It's an interesting question, a very complicated and long answer. I hope I've given you just an idea of. Incidentally, I forgot to tell you, it's also about practice. So to be a hunter is not just to become a hunter. It's not enough to be told stories and sort of, but one has to practice in the field. It's very much about practice. With respect to gender, it's really sons who hunt. Hunters will tell you again these stories. They might refer to a daughter who has the passion to hunt, but they wouldn't really encourage that beyond a certain age. They would say no, sort of, it's a boy's thing, really. I mean, this may change, and maybe it's changing a bit. it's changed in other contexts. But so far in Malta, it's really a man's thing to hunt. Of course, again, a very interesting question, because sometimes hunters will refer you specifically to women hunters. There's one, two, I know of five, for example. But I have a gut feeling that this is a kind of discourse that taps into gender equality discourses. because, of course, and I can understand why, hunters are reluctant to say that hunting is a man's thing, because that makes it seem out of sync with contemporary notions of gender equality. And remember, being out of sync is an accusation that hunting has had quite a bit of. I remember a poster, a BirdLife Malta poster, sometime in the 90s, I think, or early 90s it was, of a kind of a prehistoric man dragging a club, very hairy, you know. And the caption that said, "Fil edem essenziali l-lum saret banali." That means that was essential in the past, now it's banal, essentially. And even in cartoons, I think you may remember the cartoon I showed you, hunters are always portrayed as kind of very, almost prehistoric, hairy and, you know, how shall I put it, survivors almost, dinosaurs, no? from a previous age.
Huh? Neanderthal is the word.
Exactly, Neanderthal is very, very commonly used, you're right. And hunters, of course, resist this, understandably. And the last thing they would be happy to say is that it's a very gender-segregated thing, because that would locate it, at least as far as perception is concerned, into another time zone, which would work brilliantly for the anti-hunting people. So it's an interesting question.
Thank you, Mark. I was really looking for this paper. It's much needed. Now, you explain with Tim Ingold and your fantastic ethnographies that it's not just being there. Being a hunter is not just being in the countryside. That the fact that you're there to kill a bird is the mean to engage with the space, right? So now I'm really expecting to learn about what's the fun about killing a bird.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? You're asking the wrong person, Elise, because I've never been a hunter, and sort of, but of course, when you ask, hunters realize that hunters are not kind of cruel people or nasty people or anything. And they realize that there is a bit of an issue with this. The response is always that the act of killing is almost incidental, that it's not the pleasure one takes in the act of killing. In any case, they say that they take no pleasure at all in that. But rather it's a means to an end, really. But to have a bird in the hand, you need to shoot it or trap it. I'm not so sure about that. I think there is a certain almost tactile aesthetics of killing. Again, I should emphasize, please, I'm not saying that hunters are cruel people or not at all. I should like to emphasize this. I mean, the act may be a cruel one, but I think it would be very, very hard to argue for hunting without factoring in an aesthetics of killing, but almost the ritual of the kill. There's a good book on hunting. The title is A View to a Death in the Morning. The view to a death, to a kill, I think is an essential part of hunting. And you know, in the paper I mentioned people who go to Argentina, who shoot, say, thousands, I don't know.
Massive.
Huge numbers, yeah, doves, especially doves, sometimes hundreds of doves in a couple of weeks.
It's very hard to explain that using valuations of the environment arguments, and you know, it's Argentina. I can hardly place it on a map, let alone sort of. I think there, this aesthetics of shooting and killing. I mean, there is of course also the element of shooting, of aiming, and you know, there is that, and weapons. Exactly. I mean, there are, for example, people who shoot at targets. So. And they seem to take pleasure in that. I cannot understand what it's all about. But I think definitely the pleasure of the moment of the kill is there.
Isn't there a vocabulary,
something like expression? No, there isn't. There isn't, as far as I know, a textual vocabulary. Mm. But there is, say, a body language vocabulary. Someone might, for example, tell you that the minute I shot the bird, I was, you know, trembling, roda, a kind of the effervescence almost, or the emotion. And also, hunters will also, for example, talk about a bird that was flying really erratically, which they managed to shoot. This is, again, definitely not just a mortar. I talked about grouse moors today, and it's all about that. They're a prized game bird precisely because they are hard to shoot. So there is an aesthetics of killing, to be sure. And then, of course, there is the corollary of that, cooking birds, and you would be very interested in that. There is that. And also, I couldn't, of course, I have no time to go into this, but this camaraderie that I mentioned involves also communal meals, usually held around the end of the season, but not necessarily, but usually around the end of the season. Hunters might pool their doves, for example, or quail, or whatever it is, prepare a communal meal somewhere in the countryside. Kind of a bit like a fancata, but... there are the corollaries of... But that doesn't really... The question, I think, cannot be avoided. Or your question cannot be avoided, because these are all, you know, escape clauses. Okay, because you eat it, because you're in touch with the environment, because... But what about the moment of killing itself? I think there is an aesthetics of that. Because, for example, I agree with you that can be a part of it. The game aspect of hunting. But, for example, in fact, birds are called game. But, for example, a hunter will shoot a sitting duck. It's parallel to the Maltese. Which means a bird is there, you know, resting on the rocks or anything, and they will shoot it. And that's not considered unsporting. It's considered making the most of an opportunity, really. So I don't think, like I said, I mean, on the one hand, I don't think we should idealize. There is the game aspect to it and all that, but it's not just about that. It's also about the act of killing and bagging something, actually catching something. That is an essential part of hunting, I find.
Yes, because, Mark, you built your argument based on the fact, which is not true, that the hunters shoot turtle doves.
No, and, you're right.
And it's as if there's a challenge in shooting these difficult birds. In actual fact, it's not true. They shoot at anything that goes by, and most of the time it is not difficult at all. They try to justify their hunting by saying that they shoot at turtle doves, which are difficult and all the things that you said, but which in truth is not.
Okay, there are two sort of answers there. First of all, for obvious reasons, I kind of limited it to turtle doves. But it's not just about political correctness, so to speak. It's also because when hunters talk to you about hunting, apart from taxidermy, they will very often talk about gami mensumin. Irrespective of the law, so they might shoot a golden oriole or whatever, but you know, I'm not ruling that out. But when the law of hunting is discussed, even between them when they talk, actually gamim, especially gamim and sumin, are the birds they really talk about. So, and they are very highly prized birds, as you know, in spite of the fact that, I don't know, an eagle might be something else for someone who is really into taxidermy. But it's almost impossible, for example, to stop hunters from hunting if a good migration day happens to coincide with the close season. Well, of turtle doves, I mean. That's a really difficult, because turtle doves are embedded in the lore of hunting. So, yes, of course, you're right, that it is definitely not just about turtle doves, and if I gave you that impression, Paul is entirely right. No, not just that. After all, why would one limit oneself to one species? Let's face it. But the lore of hunting, what I was talking about, landscape and all that, is very much represented in terms of turtle doves and quail. And not just because someone is looking, because the anthropologist is looking. It is very much a world constructed around those two species. That, of course, then doesn't rule out, with respect to what you said, hunters, we shoot anything that flies. I obviously will refrain from commenting on that for obvious reasons. Some do, some don't. Well, but let's not go into that, because this is a never-ending argument, or it's not an argument at all, actually. But the point is that what I said about turtle doves and so on holds for any bird, really. Leading lines, trees. So if you're interested in shooting golden orioles, you still need trees to attract your golden orioles. So the argument of planting trees along Shfariyeh holds. The only difference would be that, of course, the type of transformations would vary according to species. So you're right that it's not that it will be a mistake to, as it were, assume that hunting in Malta is just about turtle doves and quail. I completely agree with you there. For example, I did mention thrushes. Forget the protected birds, Schedule 1. I didn't mention thrushes or ducks, for example. Lots of birds that can be shot legally. I did mention those. But again, the reason is this, that I think what I said about holds for, the principle, that is, holds for other species as well. That's my defense. But in no way do I deny that hunters may shoot other species.
Mark, there are many types of hunters in Malta. Not only the ones you are talking about. The trappers are hunters. The poachers are hunters. The young hunters are different from the old hunters. The old hunters used to hunt everything when they were small, and now they got, so they have different mentality. And I think you have to, but it's all about taking something home, I see hunting.
I agree.
It's egoism. If there are no birds, I collect snails to take home. If there are no snails, no, I go and nibble the broad beans or steal from a field broad beans. You know, so it's all about egoism, hunting. Even the land changed for the purpose of taking something home. You know,
it's
trapping sites on garrig, eucalyptus trees in Gozo, for example. You know, this is all done for taking something.
Yes.
Egoism, you know, taking something.
Yes, you make two points, Ray. The second one, I think, how shall I put it? Ray's is a legitimate point of view coming from a particular perspective. And, you know, I could have done a paper on bird watchers or conservationists, you know. Let's leave aside the word egoism But I because ego, the term egoism is a term of moral valuation, and that's what my paper was also about.
Something for
yourself. Yes, yes. Completely.
And then
my paper factored in that element. So I said that hunting is morally evaluated in certain terms, and you know, you've just done that as you have a right to do. That's your moral evaluation of it. You understand, of course, hunters would see it completely differently. Well, your first point, I think, is more what you say. There are different types of hunters. Ray is right, of course. I'm calling Ray is an old friend of mine in bird life and all that, who I should say taught me quite a lot of lore linked to bird watching. Because, like I said, I could have done this paper about bird watchers, really focusing on bird watchers, how they study leading lines and how to convert a bird in flight into a record, essentially something tangible, which you also circulate in social circles, all right, on Facebook these days or wherever, or the birds, world's bird, and the calls, the various calls of birds, which are such an important part of bird watching. In any case, but Ray is talking about different types of hunters. I think what you have in mind is a typology rather than different type. So it's not, for example, that Mark and Ray are two hunters, and Mark is so and Ray is such. I think there is a typology of how one locates oneself with respect to the law, but that can, the same person can actually be very situationally. So, for example, I know hunters who are very much, who have a huge antipathy towards people who shoot swans and things like that. But then on occasion they will shoot a swallow, for example, just like that. So which type would they be? Would they?
I would like to know how many types there are and how much types there are.
Very interesting.
For example, there are 100 that obey the law.
You can't do that. Let me tell you, you can't do that because I'm saying it's not a matter of one is either or. It's a typology that one can commute between according to situation. So there will be a day on which Hunter A is a perfectly well-behaved, you know, person. Sort of, and I've seen this. I mean, I can vouch for it. I'm sure you have as well. Almost any hunter can do that. The following day, that same hunter will shoot a pipit, for example, just so that the dog can have some fun playing with it or something. Which type of hunter would Hunter A be? It's situational. It's one commutes between. And hunters have this typology in mind very much. And they use usually metaphors to explain it. So they might use the metaphor of age. They say tfal, tfaliyet, for example. But the following morning, they themselves would be the tfal.
Yes. Or they have been tfal.
And they
have shot many illegal, protected birds when they were young, because I thought
that also. Yeah, of course.
You know?
Of course. And some of them will do so again. I mean,
my age and say I only shoot.
And some of them will do so again, because it's not a matter of you choose your type and then you sort of stay put in it for. It's very, very situational. That's why, of course, law enforcement matters. because that's the logical end of that. So you're completely right on that. I agree. I'm not making a statement. I can say I have many hunter friends. All right, so, you know. But Ray is right about this. No question about that. But I think what I described about the relation between hunter and landscape would work for type A, B, C, and so on and so on. Because, for example, a hunter who shoots a honey buzzard would still locate himself along a leading line. And although, and that's where I think your point gets a bit interesting, gets very interesting, I should say, because it's interesting generally. When shooting protected birds, I think there is a stronger incidental element about it.
So one might have the whole setup for turtle doves and quail, and this is also, but then if a honey buzzard flies along, they might shoot it. So there is that incidental element about it. So they wouldn't necessarily be observing the leading lines for honey buzzards and transforming the land for honey buzzards, at least not these days, I think. But if one happens to fly along, you know, in court recently there was the case of the guy who shot the short-toed eagle. and his...
A short-toed eagle,
a different type of eagle.
Okay.
I mean, not one, very, very short, but this one was arraigned in court. And someone was telling me what he told the magistrate is jaw-dropping, actually. He told him, jekk tad-dinja jajkla, I'll translate, jekk tad-dinja jajkla nal-ela l-istaġun. If an eagle flies over, I will definitely close its season. So there is this incidental element to it. So he's not necessarily looking for, but if an eagle flies past, it's had it. That same person might be a very well-behaved hunter on another day. It's very fluid. But yes, you are very right in pointing this out. I agree with you. I mean, I wasn't
hunting a mule, that's not like hunting in some European countries.
In the sense it is.
It's a Mediterranean type of country.
In the sense I explained it is, because it's a set, it's about practices. Now whether or not you shoot at protected bears and all that, that's almost incidental to my argument, really. You're right about saying that there are different... I am not... the paper wasn't trying to idealize hunters or to construct a myth of the gentleman hunter. Not at all. In fact, part of the difficulty in writing this is eschewing moral evaluations, my own moral evaluations, partly because I live in Malta, and Malta hunting is a very charged topic, so it's almost impossible to discuss hunting without moral evaluations. Partly also because of my past, and I mean, I still birdwatch on occasion, but I'm no longer kind of a very active. My past, as I used to be a bird ringer as well, and all that, and also my present, in which I almost commute between bird watching and being in the field with hunters, which can be a very strange setup, by the way. It's not easy field work. No field work is easy, but this one is Theodosopoulos had the same problem on Zakynthos, because he went there to protect turtles as part of a group that protected turtles, and he ended up doing field work with hunters and people who were against the protection of turtles on various grounds, and almost sympathizing with them. He explains it, for him there was kind of a moment of epiphany, as he says, a road to Damascus moment. He says that at one point he was in a protest, protesting in favor of the protection of turtles, and the protest was attacked, and someone hit him with a big stick. And apparently this made him see things differently. He's joking, of course. But he needs this epiphanic moment in order to explain his location in the field. So far it hasn't happened to me, thankfully.
Mark. Thank you very much for a wonderful, wonderful, thought-provoking...
Thank you for coming.
...talk and paper, and we hope you come back again with more observations.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Birds Hunting and Landscape in Malta. This talk was delivered by Professor Mark Antley Falson.